The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back, America. That music means David M. Drucker joins me from the Washington Examiner. You see him often on Fox News. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
I hope we can get you on Skype soon. We would like to see you at 6 a.m. in the morning or 7 a.m. in the morning. We'd like to see what David Drucker looks like, the ever dapper David Drucker.
If I'm on a screen, I look the same way.
All right. Just check. We really want you on a screen. Let me tell you about the last five Biden job approval rating polls. They are, and these are in ascending order, the last five. Joe Biden, 45. Joe Biden, 39% approval. ABC Washington Post, Joe Biden, 39% approval, 45% approval, 45% approval, 42% approval, average 42.8. I think the ABC Washington Post poll at 39 must have struck the White House as very bad news, David. And on top of it, the global financial crisis is going to emerge in the next 30 days, along with a hurricane. I just don't want to be a Democrat anywhere in the United States right now.
Well, look, Hugh, I mean, I think this gets to what we have been talking about. And I think what the reporting shows is that the fundamentals of this election cycle still favor the Republicans, even if, first of all, you always play the averages with the polls, right? That's number one. Some look really good for you. Some look really bad for you. Play the averages. And I think the average tells us with Joe Biden's approval rating that it may not be as bad as it was at the beginning of the summer, but it's not like it's had some kind of miraculous turnaround that puts the Democrats in a remarkably better place heading into the midterm elections. I will say, again, what we talked about last week and what I keep saying, the one thing to keep an eye on theoretically, that could make this election cycle a little bit different, is that Democratic enthusiasm has recovered a lot. But Republicans were always and still are very enthusiastic to vote. So the gap between the two is smaller, and that could matter in some races. But the underlying fundamentals, the economy not doing well, what voters think of how the two parties are handling the economy, what they think of Joe Biden's handling of the economy, plus some other issues, still leave the underlying fundamentals in a place where, especially with these low margins that Republicans have to overcome to win control of Congress, they only have to win a handful of seats in the House, one net seat in the Senate. They remain in a very good place.
Let me read you just some headlines why I think the White House is beleaguered. Remember, voting has begun, America, in Minnesota and Virginia, I believe a few other places. Dow Industrials fall into bear market. Blue chip index declines 330 points, its fifth straight day down. CBO, White House plan to relieve student loan debt costs $400 billion. That is a Washington Post. It's repeated in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. $400 billion, $400 billion, $400 billion. So inflation, they're just throwing $400 billion onto the fire. You know, David, I understand that the average of the polls appeals to some. But the head of Trafalgar was out last night saying polling still does not get the Trump voter. They do not get rural Americans. They don't participate. I think these numbers are low for Republican turnout. And if I'm right, just indulge me, what's that mean if the pollsters are undercounting Republicans at this point?
Well, look, if the pollsters are undercounting Republicans, obviously it's going to be a very good day versus just a good day for Republicans, right? I mean, if they're undercounting Republicans, then, you know, we could still be in a massive wave scenario. What I would caution about the undercounting of Republicans, which has been a thing in 2016 and in some polls in 2020, is this. The 2018 midterm election polling was pretty darn good and pretty accurate. It showed us Republicans were going to gain a couple of Senate seats on net, but also lose a couple of Senate seats. It showed us Democrats were going to gain about 40 or so House seats, and they did. And so some of this is a Trump phenomena thing when Trump is on the ballot. But even in 20, with some massive polling misfires, it still showed us accurately that that Arizona and Georgia were competitive in a way they had not been previously. And even when you look at the 2016 polling, the underlying polling for House races in that cycle was all correct, which is why some people were able to understand that there was a good possibility Trump was going to win, even when a lot of people didn't think he wouldn't. So sometimes there are polling misfires. That's something to consider. I think sometimes people lean on that too much when trying to game out, in other words, predict what's going to happen several weeks from now.
Where I come down, David, is that the last four major elections outside the United States, Brexit, the Boris Johnson election, the Sweden election, the Italian election, all undercounted their right-wing vote. And nationalism and the anti-immigrant vote. And now we add in an inflationary crisis and a global economic crisis. It's just you don't want to be president right now. And it's going to be like 1978. And I'm not suggesting 2010. There aren't 63 seats to lose, right? The Democrats can't lose 63 seats because of they've already lost a lot of them. But I still think 25 is a good over-under. And now I'm leaning towards the over. How about you? In the House,
I'm not leaning over yet. But look, in 1982, with a president who won one landslide and would win another, the party in power still lost 26 House seats. That was the Republicans under Ronald Reagan. So history tells us Republicans are in a much better position.
I agree. David M. Drucker on Twitter. Thank you. Let's get the Skype working next week, David. We want to see what David Drucker looks like early in the morning. He's always so nattily attired. Byron York is next, America. Stay tuned.
Hey, everyone. This is Dwayne Patterson, producer of The Hugh Hewitt Show. I've known for a while now that there's been far too much of me here in the studio, and I finally needed to do something about my weight. My excuse was always that I couldn't follow a plan with the crazy schedule that I keep. I heard about PhD Weight Loss and Nutrition and how they customize their program for each client, and I decided to call. This was no problem for Rachel and the PhD team. They had me map out what my day looks like and created a plan to follow. And so far, I've lost 16 pounds already and I'm just 2 weeks in on the way to my goal of losing 45. Call PhD Weight Loss and Nutrition at 864-644-1900 and make your appointment for your consultation. The plan is simple. It's based on science and nutrition. There's no pills or injections, and they even include 80% of your food if you want it. Call them right now at 864-644-1900 or find them online at myphdweightloss.com and tell them you heard about it from Dwayne, the producer Hugh actually has on The Hugh Hewitt Show.
Studio North, Byron York is my guest. Yes, Byron, of course, chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. You also see him on Fox many nights. Good morning, Byron.
Good morning, Hugh.
First, I'm going to lobby you in the future to let us use your Skype connection so I can see what you look like this early in the morning. Byron.
You know, I heard you saying that with David Drucker, and I'm going to be a harder sell on that.
But, you know, why is that? That people who normally are so nattily attired when they're on the Fox studio don't want to do Skype with me.
So do you think I have a coat and a tie and a pocket square on like right now?
I think Dreyer sleeps in them, so I was hoping you would. So Drucker, sleeps in them. Byron, sometimes the best question when it's as complicated a situation is just what's top of your mind right now? What do you think is going on?
Well, the thing I'm thinking about right now is midterms and the lessons of history, whether lessons of history work until they don't. And the reason I was thinking about this, you've been talking about this ABC Washington Post poll.
Right.
It's done by Langer Research, and they included a note in their analysis that went along with the poll, and it was about the midterms and Joe Biden. Now, the poll shows that Joe Biden is dragging his party down. Job approval rating, 39%. Just 35% of Democrats said they want him to run in 2024. So the analysis says each election has its own dynamic. That's the CYA sentence there. But in midterm elections since 1946, when a president has had more than 50% job approval, his party lost an average of 14 seats. That's even when they're above 50%, they tend to lose some number of seats. When the president's approval rating has been less than 50%, as Biden's is by a considerable margin now, his party has lost an average of 37 seats. Now, the argument for Democrats right now is that our condition today is just so different that this historical lesson does not apply. My feeling is that it probably does. On the other hand, I do remember, as I'm sure you do, the Blue Wall, which was this group of states that had voted Democrat for president in all six elections between 1992 and 2012. And the idea was that in 2016, with Donald Trump running, they would vote Democrat again, like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And they didn't. So I'm just trying to feel for my own use how valuable these historical analogies are.
A couple of notes on that. The ABC Washington Post poll is the one about which I have the greatest amount of suspicion, because they were off the most in a critical moment in 2020, saying Wisconsin would go for Joe Biden by 17 points. When
yep.
It was in fact 0.6. And so, but perhaps that compels them to be as accurate as possible. In the past, they may have been lackadaisical about finding Republicans. This time, they're not going to get embarrassed a second time, because pollsters don't want to be wrong. That they don't want to be wrong. They lose business when they're wrong. But the second thing is recency bias. An off-year election is not dominated by a president. It's dominated by party politics and by general trends, much like Great Britain's most recent elections, Sweden's, and Italy. I talked about this yesterday with Walter Russell Mead, whose, by the way, exploration of the origins of Trumpism at the end of the Ark of a Covenant is quite unique and impressive. I talked to him about yesterday the anger with elites is deep in the world, Byron. That does not help out the Democratic Party.
It does not. And I do think you saw that in Italy. The anger with the elites in Brussels is huge. So, yes, this is happening. And to me, all the signs point still to a pretty large Republican victory in the House. I know you're more confident in the Senate. I just don't know. I can't tell right now. But as far as the House is concerned, it looks like a solid Republican win to me.
Right. It is so solid. When Mike DeWine is up 23 points in Ohio, J.D. Vance is going to win. Now, Pennsylvania is more difficult. I think Oz is a much better position than he was 3 months ago, and that he's tied with Fetterman. But Shapiro is probably going to lay one on Mastriano the way that DeWine's going to lay it on the unnamed Democrat in Ohio. And Selena Zito tells me they split tickets, but that's a real challenge. Byron, this is the dog that didn't bark. And I wonder if maybe American media is missing a big story. Washington Post, CBO, White House plans to relieve student loan debt costs $400 billion. New York Times headline, yep. White House student loan forgiveness could cost about $400 billion. Wall Street Journal, Biden student loan forgiveness plan could cost $400 billion. CBO. They never talk about the student loan bailout. They never discuss it. I think it must be the worst political move ever in a fall run-up.
That was absolutely fascinating. You're right. And, you know, Tom Bevin this morning tweeted that this $400 billion number, said this makes an absolute travesty, a mockery of our system, where Congress is supposed to appropriate money, and the president just spends it on his own. Now, it was interesting. It has been noted that the president, when he announced this debt cancellation, said it was a, quote, game changer. And since then, he's given more than 20 speeches, and he doesn't mention it. I think he's mentioned it in one of them. So he's going out and campaigning, and he's going out and talking to fundraisers and things like that, and he's not talking about the student loan relief, which is really interesting for something that he called a quote, game changer.
And you know who is? Republicans talk about it at every turn. They want to remind people. And so what does that tell you, Byron, when Republicans want to talk about something that Democrats did and Democrats don't want to talk about it?
The lesson there is pretty obvious. Republicans think there is political advantage in it, and Democrats are scared about it. And it's just one of the many things they are scared of. I think you were talking about gas prices are going back up now.
Yep.
In all the polls, you know, there was this brief period, and there was a lot of hopeful reporting saying that abortion would be a decisive factor in a lot of these races. Now, it's going to be a factor in some of the races. I don't think it should be completely dismissed. It's going to be a factor in some. But the fact is, the number one issue absolutely remains inflation. And you know how a lot of pollsters separate the two questions, inflation and jobs/economy? Well, yeah. Jobs/economy is coming up big as Americans worry about a recession. I mean, if you listen to what Jerome Powell said last week when the Fed raised rates, I mean, he basically said, you can forget about a soft landing. I'm sorry, yeah. but you can just forget
it's
about it.
It's a recession. It's a recession. Yeah. Byron, I want to close by, you probably know John Ellis and yep. from your years at Fox News. And John Ellis, I read his news items every morning. I have for years. It's the one Substack that I actually spend money on, and I will invest in it, and I will be happy to invest in it when he makes it bigger because it's the real news. The Ellis News Items newsletter from Substack this morning is simply put, the global financial crisis is upon us, and none of the tools that were used in 07, 08 can be used this time because inflation is a core part of the problem. They can't cut interest rates. They have to raise them. They can't print money. They have to squeeze the money supply. It's kind of dire. Now, America is going to be the only one not crushed by it, but some segments will be because some of us depend, not me, but some of us depend upon international markets, which are collapsing.
Well, I understand what you're saying. I haven't read that newsletter, but I've read similar analyses. And I'm afraid they're true. I don't like to go on television or radio and say, oh, the sky is falling. Things are going to be terrible when I don't really know that. So I won't say that. But, I mean, when you listen to Chairman Powell, you're clearly saying a recession is going to happen. And if you've listened to a lot of the analysis about a recession, it's not whether we're going to have one. It's going to be how severe it's going to be and how long it's going to last.
And let me interject. I think it's going to be terrible in China. I don't know about the United States, and I know it's a challenging environment in Great Britain, but Liz Truss and her chancellor have done the Reagan thing. They have slashed taxes. It's a bold experiment. The first week is, you know, the pound falls. Of course, it's going to fall because they're playing supply-side game, Byron. How important is it that it worked there so that we can copy it here?
Well, I think it's with a Democratic president, I'm not sure how that happens here. So if the Congress is divided between the House and Senate, I just don't see that actually happening here. It was a bold plan. I mean, the pound went to like $1.03 or something, which is unprecedented.
Yep.
But it ain't going to happen here, I don't think.
What I'm thinking is going to happen here in 2025. This is as Thatcher was to Reagan, so Truss is to X, I hope. Byron York, follow him on Twitter, watch him on Special Report and all day long on Fox News. Really the best prepared. When I'm sitting next to Byron, I know I'm next to someone who is prepared thoroughly for panel time. Thank you, Byron. From number one New York Times bestselling author Vince Flynn comes Oath of Loyalty. Mitch Rapp confronts a very different kind of killer in the explosive new thriller in the best-selling Vince Flynn series, written by Kyle Mills. In the game of politics, some ties must be severed. But the oath of loyalty can never be broken. Oath of Loyalty by Vince Flynn, now available wherever books are sold. Go buy it today. I had a chance to interview the author, Kyle Mills, so go to my podcast to listen to that full interview. Oath of Loyalty by Vince Flynn.
Beyond the sea, somewhere.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt at Studio North, joined by Admiral James Stavridis, retired United States Navy, former Allied Supreme Commander of NATO, former Commander of Southern Command, now Chairman of the Rockefeller Foundation, and Man About Town. His most recent book, of course, has to do with making hard choices and decisions at sea. It's called To Risk It All. I recommend it highly for your Christmas list. Good morning, Admiral. How are you?
Doing great.
Admiral, let me talk with you about Russia first and foremost. They are apparently massing troops across the border close to Kharkiv with the intention of beginning another offensive. Would you update us on how you see the war in Ukraine going and what a Russian offensive would look like and mean for the battle?
Yeah, we're obviously in phase three of this conflict. Phase one, Putin tries to sweep across the whole country, abject failure. Phase two, Russia falls back into this crescent of territory in the east, tries to defend it, grinding warfare for several months. And then phase three, let's call it the Ukrainian offensive phase, very successful, obviously, in the east, where you described, Hugh. And I would keep an eye to the south. Clearly, What the Ukrainians want to do is get back as much, if not all, of their territory, but they also want to prepare to come to a negotiating table from the strongest possible position. So I think they'll continue to roll strong in the east, but keep watching the south. They may try and isolate Crimea, where there are many Russian troop formations, more Russian aircraft, the headquarters of the Black Sea Fleet. They may try and make a move to the south as well.
Admiral, I've talked to people about the Putin threat to use nuclear weapons. Jake Sullivan's response on the Sunday shows, we would have a catastrophic response. Only two books have dealt with this, thinking about the unthinkable, in the last couple of years. One is Never by Ken Follett. The other is 2034 by you and Elliot Ackerman. So you're one of the people who have actually thought through this. What kind of scenario do you envision Putin actually using a weapon of mass destruction?
Well, first of all, we've got to take it seriously. He's someone who has often followed through on what he's threatened to do. He's been at pains to tell us he's not bluffing. Volodymyr Zelensky, who knows him quite well and has studied him for years, believes he is not bluffing. So, A, we got to take his threat seriously. B, I think it's unlikely, my own assessment, that he would choose to certainly reach for the lever to a nuclear apocalypse. You know, he's not going to launch a massive strategic nuclear attack because he knows that would end up with his own death and destruction of Russia. And as much as I dislike Vladimir Putin, my assessment is he truly loves his country. So he's not going to go for a massive strategic attack. Well, that brings us to C. How would he use perhaps a smaller size, so-called tactical nuclear weapon? I think one of two ways. He could use it as a demonstration out in relatively uninhabited territories in Ukraine. You know, it's a big, in many places, empty country. He could do a demonstration strike and say, hey, the next one goes to Kyiv. Or he could use it against a significant tactical formation of the Ukrainian military, probably taking out a significant chunk of infrastructure inside. Both of those are horrific. The question is, how do we deter him from doing that? I think the administration is doing everything possible, which is, A, to talk about it, to shine a light on it, to move it into the conversation, because it'll help, if you will, swing votes in the relatively unaligned parts of the world, India, South Africa, Brazil, Nigeria, this big world of the South, which is still kind of playing the ball down the middle. And then secondly, tell Putin very specifically, hey, if you use a nuke of any size at all, we're going to enter this war. We're putting up a no-fly zone. We're going to attack Russian troops. We're going to sink the Black Sea Fleet. You know, we've got a lot of conventional options. And we also say to Putin, cyber. We'll come after you in the cyber war. So apologize for the length of the answer, but it's a pretty important question to you.
Oh, so is this next one. I know my strategic weapons pretty well, and I know what they can do. But the phrase tactical nuclear weapons has always been a spectrum. It's an accordion term. It can go from anything to anything. What is, like, the least amount of damage one could do? Just tell the audience made up of civilians like me, what are we talking about here?
You're talking about a weapon that, in terms of comparison with conventional explosives, a smaller nuclear weapon is thousands and thousands to 10,000 times the size. So think an explosion that would destroy a big city block, and also, more importantly, any nuclear release is going to entail a great deal of radiation going into the atmosphere. That's where it becomes a larger-than-life weapon, if you will, because that radiation can move, depending on how wind shifts, and sicken and kill major civilian population. It becomes uncontrollable beyond the explosive effect. So you're absolutely right, Hugh. There's no such thing as a tactical nuclear weapon. It's just a smaller version of the really big city busters that are strategic.
So the mother of all bombs, the MOAB, relative to a MOAB, Are tactical nuclear weapons inevitably even bigger than a MOAB?
Some of them are in that range, but almost all tactical nuclear weapons, the so-called backpack weapons, the ones that are used or not used, let us hope, hypothetically useful at the very smaller end of it, are somewhat bigger than the MOAB that you're describing. Both are extremely lethal. The big difference is, of course, the MOAB is a one-and-done effect, a huge explosion, but it doesn't have that lingering radiation that comes with the smaller nuclear device.
So we will inevitably know if one has been used. There's no signature that can be erased.
Yes.
Okay,
correct.
So the moment that happens, what do you expect the United States to do and its NATO allies? You were the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. I assume there are plans in drawers that are being dusted off for this.
Certainly, all of our forces would go on the highest stage of alert. You have to remember, NATO, of course, is not just the United States. It's a nuclear alliance. So the French, the British nuclear forces, our nuclear forces, our conventional forces, everything would immediately spike in terms of readiness. Our entire intelligence system would hone in on the point of explosion. I think from a narrative perspective, we'd be doing absolutely everything to solidify the view that this was a Russian event. Russia would no doubt be trying to false flag it, try to imply that it was the U.S. that had used a nuclear weapon for whatever reason. So we'd have to be doing all the informational aspects of this. We'd also have to be following through on whatever those terms are that we have conveyed that Jake Sullivan was talking about to the Russians as to catastrophic effects. Certainly there's a diplomatic, economic piece of this, but I think on the military side, it would be a major cyber event. We would go offensive on cyber. I think we would probably go after elements of the Black Sea Fleet. I think we would go after Russian troop formations inside Ukraine. I think we would put up a NATO no-fly zone immediately. We would turn even more taps on for equipment going to the Ukrainians. Hopefully Putin is receiving the message that this would be the worst possible decision he could make. It would utterly energize the alliance to take military action against him.
Three questions for 3 minutes, Admiral. One, the delivery mechanism that the Russians would likely use. I haven't heard that talked about much. Number two, do you think we have dusted off and forward deployed anti-radiation stuff of the sort that used to mark the Fulda Gap deployments? I'm not sure that NATO has drilled for this in a long, long time. And then finally, General Kellogg in a green room told me the one thing he wishes America do would be to surge the artillery. It is basic doctrine. You never hold back on the artillery. Use all the shells that you've got. And that if we've got HIMARS that are going there, we need to hurry them up. What do you think?
Question three, yes on HIMARS, yes on more artillery, and add the ATACMS, which is the HIMARS on steroids, 200-mile as opposed to the 50-mile HIMARS. The delivery mechanism, hard to say. It could be a gravity bomb. It could be a surface-to-surface missile, or it could be a, if you will, a backpack weapon that a soldier carries, is in place for it and then detonated from a distance. In terms of are we ready for it, are we dusting off, I think we're more than dusting off. I don't know this, but I'll put it this way. If I were Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, I would be emphasizing preparation for combat in a not only radiation environment, but also a chemical and potentially biological direction. All of this, Hugh, is horrific to contemplate, but the more we talk about it, the more we convey to Russia consequences, the less likely Vladimir Putin will make the mistake of a century, of many lifetimes in reaching for the nuclear option.
But and Admiral, I only bring it up because I remember the walkie-talkies didn't work on 9/11. There are things you don't prepare for because nobody imagines them. You're telling me that NATO imagines everything and prepares for everything.
I think in this instance, NATO is most definitely imagining the dark end of this scenario. And I'm recalling a moment, Hugh, when you and I in early 2020 were talking about COVID and the potential for that to spread. It really happened. The more we talk now about the consequences, I hope the less likely it is that Putin will reach for this option.
It's a last question, Admiral. It has not generally dominated the news, because I don't think that Americans generally think about the unthinkable in the way that we did prior to 1989. I'm sure it was your bread and butter at the academy and your strategy classes, and when you were an admiral, when you were running NATO. It just isn't much talked about anymore.
All people, everywhere, it's a human quality to think that tomorrow is going to be a lot like today. Maybe a little different, but basically the same. But there are hinge moments in history. We may be living through one. And if Putin reaches for a nuclear weapon, we're definitely in the middle of one. That's why we wrote the book, 2034, A Novel of the Next World War, to help us imagine. It's a work of cautionary fiction. We all ought to be paying attention to the dark end of the spectrum at the moment.
Admiral, thank you very much. I agree. That's why I tell people to get 2034, but also don't forget the other Admiral books, because you might have to make decisions in a very tough situation. To Risk It All will help you. Thank you, Admiral. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. They're with Sierra Pacific. They lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Dan Balls is the chief correspondent for The Washington Post. He's actually the dean of American political correspondence. When Dan writes something, you've got to read it. He wrote in The Washington Post this weekend, along with Emily Guskin and Scott Clement, "Voters divided amid intense fight for control of Congress, poll finds." Subhead, with 6 weeks to go, Republicans hold a firm lead on the economy, inflation, and crime, but Democrats have the advantage on abortion and climate change. Dan Balls, welcome back. Your ears might be burning. I was just texting with Garen about you. He sends his regards from upstate New York.
Good morning, Hugh, and good morning to Mark, if he's tuned in this morning.
Are you going back to Harvard, though he's flown the coop from the Institute of Politics?
Yeah, I'm still doing my thing up there. I've got a part-time relationship, so I go up and back. I'm pretty well occupied right now with the election for the Washington Post. But yes, I was up there for two different weeks, parts of weeks, at the beginning of the month, as our new crop of resident fellows arrived, and I'll be back up there in the next week or so to do some more stuff. So, yeah, it's a great relationship. I really enjoy it.
My advice to every Harvard undergraduate is try and take Dan Balls out for coffee. But he's going to be very busy for the next couple of months. Dan, let's get to the key finding of the ABC Washington Post poll. I always remind people this is the poll with the most to lose this time, because they blew Wisconsin so badly 2 years ago, saying Biden would win by 17 points when he won by 0.6 points. They have to double down. Nobody wants to be the pollster who was the worst pollster in the last cycle. So when they say Joe Biden is...
Thank you for reminding me.
Well, I know, but I work there too, but I always like to tell people we're not happy with that. When that happened, nobody likes that.
No, none of us were. No, there's no question. That was a bad poll.
Yeah, so Joe Biden at 39% approval. What does that mean historically in the first off year of a presidency, Dan Balls?
Well, historically, it means that his party's going to take a pretty big beating in the election. That, you know, if you're that far under 50 historically, your party can suffer some significant losses. I would say two things about that, Hugh. One is that I think we're in an era when presidents in general and politicians in general are more likely to be, or as likely to be, underwater with their approval rating as above water. We're just in a period in which people are sour about presidents. So I think you have to keep that in mind. It doesn't negate the fact that he's well underwater. The second is that as the poll shows, this is an election in which there are kind of cross currents operating, and there's no question that inflation is a dominant issue. Crime is an issue that the Republicans are trying to make a dominant issue. And all of that argues in favor of the Republicans. But the abortion issue, the Dobbs decision, has clearly energized a part of the Democratic base. And so I think, we're looking at an election in which figuring out exactly who's going to turn out, it may be a little bit trickier.
Now, Dan, I've always thought of off years as the closest thing we come to parliamentary style elections, where it's party versus person. The recency bias in my screen is the Brexit vote, the Boris Johnson vote, the Swedish elections and the Italian elections, which have been decidedly center right in their result. And so I think if it's a nationalized election, and this is, well, there is undeniably an impact on some marginal abortion rights minded voters. There's also an impact on some marginal pro-life voters. I think they set each other off, and it comes back to the economy, the economy, the economy. And that's pretty grim for Democrats.
Well, they've got, they've got a healthy double-digit lead on the economy and inflation. And that should be a big warning sign for Democrats. I think if you look at this poll in its totality, you come to a conclusion that isn't surprising, and that is that Republicans are on track to win the House. But that's in part because they don't have to do all that well to win the House. The question is how much their margin is likely to be by the time we get through the election. But I think they are, they are still favored to win the House, but perhaps not by as much as they were pre-Dobbs. But the other is that, so if you're Kevin McCarthy, you look at this poll and you say, good. I mean, we're moving in the direction that we need to move, and we've got to keep the pressure on. If you're Mitch McConnell, it's harder to say, okay, things are going to really be good, because a lot of these races are, these competitive Senate races are, are within the margin, and it looks as though Pennsylvania is one that the Republicans could give up. So they're going to have to find some seats to win elsewhere. Now they have some possibilities, obviously Georgia and Nevada being, two prime ones. But if you're Mitch McConnell, you can look at this poll and say, well, it doesn't tell me exactly how I'm going to feel the day after the election or by December.
No, you have to run through the tape because there'll be a runoff in Georgia in all likelihood. But I feel pretty good about Herschel, and I feel pretty good about Dr. Oz. Very confident about J.D. Vance. Very confident about Adam Laxalt. The two toss-ups are O'Day and Tiffany Smiley that you didn't mention, and Blake Masters. Can he put it on, and does the turnout? Katie Hobbs a terrible candidate. Have you followed that, Dan? I don't know if you follow Arizona. Katie Hobbs may be the worst candidate.
I think at this point I would give Mark Kelly an advantage in that race. But in the governor's race, I think that Carrie Lake could well win that.
Yeah, and I think poor Mark Kelly, he's got to deal with Katie Hobbs, who won't show up anywhere. And the difference, of course, is in Pennsylvania. And you'll know this. You know everything. You're like, I used to talk to Barone and Broder. In Pennsylvania, do they have a history of splitting tickets? Because Josh Shapiro is going to win. He's going to be on the ticket in 2024 or 2028. He's like the perfect candidate from central casting for Democrats. And I don't know if Democrats split tickets over there or independents. What do you think in the Keystone State, Dan? Would they go for Shapiro and vote for Oz?
Well, I think it depends on Shapiro's margin. I mean, we could see ticket splitting in a variety of places, right? I mean, we could see, you may be right about Herschel Walker in Georgia, but we could see a situation in which Stacey Abrams, loses and loses by, more than a couple of points, and Warnock holds on. I'm not saying that will happen, but I think that could happen. I think in Pennsylvania you could see a situation. I would be more inclined to say that Fetterman pulls that out. I think that the health issue is still, unresolved, I think, in some voters' minds probably. But I think if Shapiro is winning pretty handily, I think that gives Fetterman some help. I mean, Fetterman.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Fetterman has captured the imagination of the Democratic base. And so I think that, you know, those swing voters in Pennsylvania, of which there are clearly some, will hold the balance. But at this point, I would think that Fetterman has a little bit of an edge in that race.
Okay, let's put that aside. Dan and I will talk about that after the election, because I'm feeling very good about Dr. Oz, but he's still inclined towards Fetterman. Let's conclude, Dan, by telling you about the dog that doesn't bark. A month ago, Joe Biden announced with ruffles and flourishes the student loan bailout. Yesterday, the Congressional Budget Office said it will cost $400 billion. I am not alone in noticing that the president does not ever bring this up. Has anything ever been as off target as that in the middle of an election season?
Well, I'd have to scroll back a long time. That $400 billion number that CBO put out yesterday is going to bring that issue back to the fore. And, having talked to some voters this fall, they're Democratic voters who are clearly conflicted about this. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. I don't know whether that is going to rise to the level of being the issue that, that in one way or another really turns some of these races. I think that's the question. I think that issues like obviously inflation and crime and abortion are going to be more powerful issues in people's minds than that. So, but it was a very controversial decision, and one of the reasons we know that is it took President Biden a very 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 long time to decide to do it. That was on the table for months and months before he finally agreed to do it. So I think even in his mind, he knew that this was one that had some pluses, but also a lot of minuses.
The dog that didn't bark. Last question, Dan Balls. When we come back around at the end of all this, divided government is going to loom one way or the other. How well do you think President Biden is equipped to deal with divided government, given his age, given his sort of aggressiveness towards the semi-fascist rhetoric, et cetera? Can he actually work with the people he worked with for so long going forward?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, we've seen instances in which he's tried to work with Republicans, and there have been some bipartisan successes. And I think that, I think that that's still part of his instinct that he would like to get back to, a governing environment which he was used to for many, many years. I frankly am not convinced that that governing environment is possible today. I think he will have trouble with a House that's in Republican hands, particularly if they launch a series of investigations that he could well get his backup over. But the Senate is the institution he knows and loves, and if the Senate is in Republican hands, he'll I suspect try to work with Mitch McConnell, but I don't know how successful that will be. I just think that Hugh, we're going to get plunged into 2024. Immediately after this midterm election, and that's going to color so much of what goes on over the next 2 years.
Absolutely correct, per usual. Dan Balls, follow him on Twitter. Read everything he writes at the Washington Post. He's chief correspondent of the nation's leading newspaper for a reason.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.